Sutton versus Bernard.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Brad Friedman, and I represent the appellants in this proceeding. Your Honors, the Seventh Circuit standard governing fee awards in common fund cases is fairly well established and set forth, I think, most recently in In re Synthroid, where the court held, quote, courts must do their best to award counsel the market price for legal services in light of the risk of nonpayment and the normal rate of compensation in the market at the time. The Synthroid court also held, quote, the court must set a fee by approximating the terms that would have been agreed to ex ante had negotiations occurred. The district court in this case never cited Synthroid, never cited any of the other cases that set forth the relevant standard, and instead declined to follow these standards, and among other errors, erroneously based its analysis on inapposite fee-shifting cases, and then did that incorrectly, erroneously used an ex-post approach and drew erroneous conclusions in doing that, erroneously held that plaintiff's counsel bore no risk in the case, and erroneously gave no explanation for how it came to its 15% figure. Plaintiff's counsel had requested 28% of the gross settlement fund.
And let me stop you right there. How did class counsel derive, or how was that figure, that requested fee of 28% determined in terms of the request?
What we did was to look at what courts have in the district have generally awarded. Generally speaking, courts have awarded 33 1/3%. There are a few cases where the award has been as low as, say, 25%, mostly 33 1/3%. And we thought, given our lodestar and all the work that had been done in the case, we thought 28% being far closer to the lower number was appropriate, even though it meant we would be getting less, only 86% of our time. We were actually taking effectively a loss on the case by getting less than our total time. And what the district court's award amounted to was only 44%. It basically cut us in half and gave us far less than half of our time in the case.
Did you come across any cases that were 15% was or figures near that was awarded?
No. I did not see any cases where the figures were that low in this circuit. As Your Honor is probably aware, there is some case law in some other circuits where you have a mega fund of hundreds of millions of dollars, which, of course, was not this case. And in those cases, in other circuits, the percentage goes down as the award goes up. Of course, what the district court did here is exactly the opposite. It reduced the percentage in a case where it viewed the award as small, although, as the record shows, actually the award wasn't the result wasn't small at all. But in any event, that's not the law in this circuit. Now, the first error I'd like to highlight is that in response to class counsel's risk of nonpayment argument, which was based on a slew of Seventh Circuit cases, including Synthroid, including Continental Illinois, which was a case where the same district judge was involved, and including Florence, despite those cases, the district court in this case wrote quite, with respect to the risk of nonpayment, wrote, quote, this is a common argument in support of large fees and class actions, but it has no relationship in reality. Your Honors, this is the exact same finding for which this district court was reversed in 1992 in Continental Illinois. And then a year later, this court in that very same case granted a writ of mandamus on the fee issue because 8 months after the reversal, Judge Grady ordered a process for determining the fee issue that was inconsistent with this court's prior order. The statement by the district court also is at odds with this court's 1994 and 1995 opinions in Florence versus Nations Bank of Georgia, which also reject the notion that plaintiff's lawyers bear no risk. And I'd like to get back to Continental and Florence in a minute. But I'd state now that, you know, one need only look at some recent cases, IPO, where the Second Circuit just reversed class certification, Enron, where the Fifth Circuit reversed class certification on the grounds that there was no claim against the banks. Two recent Supreme Court cases argued just last week, CSFB versus Billing and the Telelabs case. Or the case in which the Supreme Court just accepted certiorari last week, the Charter Communications case. Not to mention this case, where even our request only amounted to 86% of Lodestar. You look at any one of those cases, and I think you can see that, that securities class actions are riskier than ever, and the notion that plaintiffs' lawyers bear no risk, in addition to being inconsistent with the case law, is just wrong. Now, it's not in my papers, but I'd also like to point out that the district court opinion here, in addition to being consistent in many ways with an analysis for which it was reversed in Continental Illinois, also appears to be consistent with a 1999 article authored by the district judge in this case, titled Reasonable Fees, a Suggested Value-Based Analysis for Judges. Now, that article is reported at 184 FRD 131. It's a 1999 article. And in that article, as you did hear, the district court judge argued for an ex post approach that is inconsistent with Synthroid and for the rejection of a risk multiplier in most class actions in a manner that's inconsistent with Synthroid, Continental, Illinois, and Florence. Interestingly, the article concedes in the second paragraph that the suggested approach, quote, departs from current practice. Second, even if an ex post approach was appropriate, and we submit it was not, the district court erred by ignoring evidence in the record with respect to the quality of the result. Here, NERA submitted an expert affidavit. It was the defendants, not the plaintiffs, who procured this affidavit, stating that the $18 million settlement in this case exceeded by $5.2 million the median predicted settlement of $12.8 million based on a statistical analysis of over 400 other settlements. That was in the record, and it's in the appendix at A313 to 320. But even if you were to use the district court's approach, which was disparaging of a recovery of 4% of recognized loss claims, published research, and I cite this in my brief at pages 26 to 27, finds that the median recovery in securities class actions is far less, only 2.8 to 3.1%. Now, I would note that the same research also rejects this entire method of analysis as irrelevant, because the amount of the recognized loss doesn't factor in such things as loss causation. I mean, basically what those cases tell you is that the mere fact that you only got 10% of the loss or 2% of the loss or 1% of the loss doesn't tell you that you could have recovered 100% of the loss at trial. Third, the district court also gave no weight to its finding that class, quote, class counsel obtained what may well be the best settlement possible under the circumstances and that, quote, class counsel tried hard and the shortfall was not of their doing. Arguably, this finding, together with class counsel's cumulative lodestar of $5.87 million, supports this court suggesting or ordering a specific award, or at the very least ordering a timetable, rather than merely remanding for further proceedings. Now, I recognize that this is somewhat controversial, and I certainly don't want to suggest anything inappropriate, so I'd like to really pause on this request. These fee proceedings cause delay in getting money to the class because we don't know how much money to distribute. Historically, this court has granted the kind of relief I've just suggested where there appeared to be a reason to do so. In 1992, in Continental 1, this court reversed Judge Grady on fees after he had taken more than a year to decide fees. And then in 1993, in Continental 2, in granting the writ of mandamus, noted that Judge Grady had taken another 8 months from the reversal before ordering a process on fees, which process was inconsistent with the court's prior order. This court also noted Judge Grady's, quote, antipathy to large awards of attorney's fees, close quote. As a result, this court directed a specific timetable on remand. A year after that, in 1994, Judge Shabazz was reversed on fees in Florin 1, largely for refusing to apply a multiplier. Then in 1995, after on remand, the district court had awarded a multiplier of 1.01. This court, an opinion that I think Your Honor authored, stated that, quote, as this is the second time that the issue of a risk multiplier has been before us, we believe that rather than waste both the district court's and the appellant's time, the appropriate risk multiplier can be resolved on appeal. I recognize this is only the first time and hopefully the only time that we're going to be up on appeal in this case. And perhaps we won't even prevail. But I'm also mindful of the history in Continental Illinois and of Judge Grady's 1999 article in which he continues to appears to continue to adhere to his views. And of course, we have the actual procedural history and the opinion in this case. I'm not going to repeat what's in the opinion, but as to the procedural history, we submitted our fee petition in March 2005. And while some degree of the delay was caused by the bankruptcy proceedings and can't be blamed on the district court judge, we still had no fee award until July 2006. I mean, there was
What was the timing in terms of the bankruptcy? Because everything stayed, basically.
Yeah. It wasn't so much that there was a it was basically stayed. I guess that's essentially right, because we needed to get those proceedings, some problems, were probably about 7 months.
7 months out of a total. Give us the time, then, from
when
we had
submitted our petition in March 2005. It was probably January of 2006 before. Honestly, the district court had all the papers before it on submission and really could have been ready to go the minute the bankruptcy proceeding was done.
But
let's assume that the district court judge says, well, I'm not going to waste my time because they're, and that's fair. The district court judge may say, well, I'm not going to waste my time thinking about this until I know that the bankruptcy court proceedings are a go. I was checking on this in the record, and it's not clear, but I think it was about January 2006.
And when was the ruling?
July of 2006.
How long would it take a different judge to get up to speed on it?
I think it wouldn't take very long at all. It's pretty clear. You know, in a case like this, the judge did make factual findings that we had a terrific result, the best that could be accommodated under the circumstances. I think the case law is pretty clear as to what percentage awards normally are, and I think it's pretty clear what our percentage, what our lodestar was. I mean, I really don't think that our request is that outrageous.
And nobody's objecting. There isn't really a
dispute not a single objector.
Resolve here.
There was not a single objector from the class. No one from the class objected to the fee, to the fairness of the settlement, to anything. There's other things I could point out, but rather than waste this court's time, I don't know if you have any questions. I mean, I can go through the fact that the Hensley v. Eckerhart analysis is just wrong. And this court has held that that's not the proper way to do things, you know, time and time again. The additional cases that district court cited was completely off point. I mean, one was a case where the court determined that a nuisance value settlement did not make you a prevailing party for purposes of the fee shifting statute. I'm not sure what relevance that has here. I don't think anybody thinks $18 million is a nuisance value settlement. Between us and the bankruptcy trustee, we got the entire insurance policy. The company was in bankruptcy. There was no other money.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement.